center which they document all these death and like bad crimes.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll do part two, put it online at democracynow.org. Wa'ad al-Khatib and Hamza al-Khatib. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 7:59. And coming up next, it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Fight the Empire at 9:30 with Per Fogarang, looking at how imperialism permeates our lives. At 10 o'clock, Heather McCoy welcomes the Portland band Body Image to the Heather McCoy Show. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Max Porter about their book Lanny. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Songs and Readings from the Ale House at the End of the World on Friday, July 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. The Ale House at the End of the World is an old story of a tyrant and a rebellion, of monsters and humans, of love and death. Know this. There are creatures who travel back and forth from the spirit world to the land of the living. This book is Stephen Allred's romp through the afterlife, written with the gusto of a great drinking song. Again, that's Songs and Readings from the Ale House at the End of the World on Friday, July 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Books Around the Corner, 40 Northwest 2nd Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a membership director, a morning news and public affairs director, and an evening news and public affairs director. The deadline to apply for these three full-time positions has been extended to July 18th by 11:59 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information on these positions and how to apply, just go to kboo.fm/employment today.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the House of Representatives on Tuesday voted to condemn President Donald Trump for using racist language against four newly elected freshman congresswomen of color. The resolution, which was brought forward by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, received the votes of all Democrats and even four Republicans, and was the strongest congressional rebuke yet of the president for his racist rhetoric. In describing the president's language as racist, Pelosi caused an uproar among Republicans who took umbrage at her accusation being on the official record.
President Ronald Reagan, he said it so beautifully in his last speech as President of the United States, which is quoted in this resolution, who said, "If we ever close the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost." Yet the President's comments about our colleagues this weekend show that he does not share those American values. These comments from the White House are disgraceful and disgusting, and these comments are racist. How shameful to hear him continue to defend those offensive words, words that we have all heard him repeat, not only about our members, but about countless others.
I was just going to give the General Speaker of the House, if she would like to rephrase that comment.
I have cleared my remarks with the parliamentarian before I read them.
And take it. And I ask the words be taken down.
That's Republican Congressman Doug Collins taking issue with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's description of Trump as racist. In the end, Pelosi's words remained on the record and the resolution passed. Following the resolution, Democrat Al Green introduced articles of impeachment against Trump, calling for an up or down vote within 2 days to get lawmakers on the record about where they stand.
A resolution condemning the president for racist comments directed at members of Congress. What do? You file articles of impeachment, impeaching the President of the United States of America. These two things are not mutually exclusive.
That's Congressman Al Green on the floor of the House on Tuesday. Democrats are apparently divided on the issue, but a vote is expected on Wednesday nonetheless to either move the resolution forward to the Judiciary Committee or kill it. The ACLU on Tuesday moved to legally challenge the Trump administration over its new and harsh asylum rules that prohibit refugees from seeking asylum if they have passed through a third country to get to the U.S. According to the complaint that was filed in a U.S. district court in San Francisco, quote, it is long-standing federal law that merely transiting through a third country is not a basis to categorically deny asylum to refugees who arrive at our shores. Meanwhile, Jewish activists with the group Never Again in Washington, D.C. targeted the headquarters of the reviled Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. While protesters rallied outside the building, 10 of their colleagues blocked the entrance and were arrested.
Now. Never again!
Abolish ICE!
Never again!
Means now!
Never again!
Abolish ICE!
Never again!
Those are the sounds of Jewish activists with the group Never Again blocking the entrance to the ICE headquarters in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. Documents released from the Drug Enforcement Administration have revealed shocking data about the extent to which pharmaceutical companies flooded the U.S. with opioid pills. Over a six-year span from 2006 to 2012, manufacturers and distributors spread 76 billion oxycodone and hydrocodone pain management pills into the U.S. At least 100,000 deaths have been attributed to the opioid crisis, and the data that was released is part of the largest civil action in U.S. history. In other news, the notorious Mexican drug lord known as El Chapo was sentenced on Wednesday to life in prison in a court in Brooklyn, New York. Joaquin Guzman Loera was tried and convicted of numerous crimes last year after being extradited to the U.S. from Mexico. Observers are marking the life imprisonment as the final chapter of El Chapo's bloody career. A federal appeals court on Tuesday handed the Trump administration another victory in the fight against labor and worker rights. A three-judge panel in Washington, D.C. decided to uphold a rule geared at attacking federal employee unions and making it easier to fire federal workers who are unionized. David Cox, who heads the American Federation of Government Employees, countered, quote, the union-busting framework laid out in the executive orders and the actions already taken at the bargaining table so far demonstrate clearly that there must be a check on the president's power to destroy federal employees' union rights. Workers with the online retail giant Amazon used its two-day Prime sale to target the company's relentless drive for profits, protesting in locations like Shakopee, Minnesota. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar called for a federal probe to investigate the treatment of workers at the 100 or so Amazon warehouses across the U.S. The company posted record profits but faced competition from other sellers. Meanwhile, the company is facing a major probe in Europe over its practices of selling products from third-party vendors. Abigail Disney, the heiress to the Walt Disney Empire, has begun speaking out against working conditions at Disneyland after she went undercover to see for herself what one worker reported to her. In an interview with Yahoo, Ms. Disney slammed Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney Corporation, saying, Bob needs to understand he's an employee, just the same as the people scrubbing gum off the sidewalk are employees, and they're entitled to all the same dignity and human rights that he is. Iger makes a salary of $66 million a year. A day after the Department of Justice announced there would be no charges against the New York police officer whose stranglehold killed Eric Garner 5 years ago, all Democratic frontrunners in the 2020 race for president denounced the decision. That is, all except former Vice President Joe Biden. Senator Bernie Sanders said, "We will not have real justice for Black Americans until there is serious reform of our racist criminal justice system." Senator Kamala Harris called it, quote, a miscarriage of justice. Our criminal justice system should be rooted in accountability. My heart breaks for the Garner family. And Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote, no one is safe in a country with a broken criminal justice system. My heart goes out to Eric Garner's family today. In the latest on the case of accused sex offender and billionaire Jeffrey Epstein, news emerged on Tuesday that while he was in jail in Florida a decade ago, Epstein continued to have, quote, improper sexual contact with underage women. An attorney representing several of Epstein's victims made the allegation. And retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens has died. Stevens led the liberal wing of the Supreme Court for years until his retirement 9 years ago. He was 99 years old and passed away earlier this week as a result of a stroke. Stevens served on the court for 35 years and was lauded for some of his decisions to balance the rightward tilt of the court. Writing in 2004 in the case of Jose Padilla, who was being held as an enemy combatant, Stevens said, quote, if this nation is to remain true to the ideals symbolized by its flag, it must not wield the tools of tyrants, even to resist an assault by the forces of tyranny. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration on Monday announced that it would begin immediately enforcing its ban on health clinics that receive tax dollars from referring pregnant women for abortions. There are currently numerous lawsuits challenging the rule, but the Department of Health and Human Services has been given the green light to begin enforcement. The move prompted a major clinic in Maine to drop out of the government's funding program. George Hill, president of Maine Family Planning, said in an interview with AP, it is objectionable that the federal government is so arrogant as to dictate what our medical professionals can and cannot say to our patients. On Tuesday, Planned Parenthood, the most high-profile abortion provider in the U.S., also chose to forego federal funds rather than stop offering abortions. In the same week, Planned Parenthood's board unexpectedly announced that it was ousting its new head, Dr. Liana Wen, over what some are characterizing as, quote, philosophical differences. My guest is Jessica Mason-Piclo, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. She's a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and former Assistant Director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and a former litigator. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So let's first explain to our audience what this rule is. This is something that the Trump administration has tried to put into place. As I said, there's numerous lawsuits. And this is, of course, part of its gift to the anti-abortionists. What is this specific rule?
Sure. So what the rule is, the gag rule that we're talking about, are actually regulations to the Title 10 Family Planning Program. And that's the federal program that provides family planning dollars to clinics across the country. And the restrictions that the Trump administration has enacted are a couple. We have what you had mentioned in the introduction, the ban on providers referring or even saying the word abortion to their patients. That's where we get the nomenclature around the gag rule. But then there are also other requirements that the Trump administration is going to begin enforcing. For example, it's already unlawful for federal dollars to go and pay for abortions. The Trump administration takes that further now and will require clinics that provide abortion services to have financial separation from the other services that they provide. And that the administration said that they will begin enforcing immediately. There's a third requirement that mandates physical separation of facilities. So that means if you are a clinic, for example, that offers medication abortion, you would have to open an entirely new facility should you want to continue to do that. Now, those requirements won't take effect until January unless those are blocked at some point. But it does not look like the courts are willing to block those at any of these at this point.
And so, of course, these are very clearly designed to ensure that federal tax dollars never pay for a woman's abortion.
Correct. And to go further, to make sure that federal tax dollars are never commingled, to borrow one of the anti-choice framing phrases, are not commingled with other services on reproductive health care. But I think it's important to unpack that, because what that is saying from the right is that they do not view abortion as health care. And that is quite simply against science. The American Medical Association disagrees with that statement very strongly, for example. So we have politicians dictating healthcare based on ideological beliefs, and it's going to have devastating consequences. There are 4 million people who currently rely on the Title X program, and their healthcare has now been immediately undercut.
Right. So this funding is basically government funding for, for low-income Americans.
Absolutely. Most of those 4 million Americans who go to Title X clinics are low-income, and they are people of color. And they're not going to Title X clinics always to have an abortion, right? What we know is that these clinics offer all sorts of care and are often the primary source of accessing healthcare for low-income Americans. So it's not just threatening access to reproductive healthcare. If the impact of this is that clinics close or they opt out and have to reduce staff, reduce hours, reduce access, that has very real and tangible effects on health outcomes for low-income people in this country.
So the how is it that although there are legal challenges to this rule, because of course we do have, it's a constitutional right for access to abortion is a constitutional right, how is it that HHS, the Department of Health and Services, is able to begin enforcing the rule?
Well, so there are a couple parts to your question. I'll start with the basic how they can. They can because the court said even though there are legal challenges and a disagreement as to whether or not the Trump administration acted lawfully when they enacted this rule, while that litigation continues, the rule can take effect. So,
and that's pretty remarkable.
It is, and unfortunately, it's not in this case, because what the court said is that it based its decision on the idea that the Trump administration was likely to win in these challenges. Yeah. And that's in large part because this gag rule is something that Republican politicians have tried in the past. And we have had litigation tied up all around it. In fact, it made it all the way to the Supreme Court in Russ v. Sullivan. And in that decision, the Supreme Court ultimately upheld restrictions that are nearly identical to the ones that the Trump administration has put in effect. The difference, though, is that we had a change in election. We had Democrats take power, and then when that fight was happening, Bill Clinton, when it was his administration, removed the requirements. So this is a political fight that's found its way into the courts, and low-income people are the footballs in this, and it's a travesty.
I quoted the head of the Maine Family Planning Clinic about, the federal government's inserting itself into discussions between doctors and patients and its decision to essentially choose to opt out of federal funding. Planned Parenthood has said the same thing. Now, what does that mean for the services that these clinics provide to low-income Americans? Does this mean that these organizations are going to have to fundraise privately for the same services, or does it mean that they stop serving the same people?
Well, hopefully it doesn't mean that they stop serving the same people. It's, you know, Planned Parenthood is an enormous organization and is in a position to better insulate itself from the financial impact. But that's not to say that it won't be devastating. But you're right. They will. Organizations and clinics are going to have to independently fundraise. They may end up cutting back, like I mentioned, access in ways by trimming staff or, you know, getting creative. But I will say this in terms of the reproductive rights community. The folks who provide access to abortion care are absolutely some of the most dedicated individuals that you will ever meet in any circumstance. And so I believe them when they say that they are fundamentally dedicated and driven to make sure that access to care to the best that they can is not rolled back. But it's going to make it much more difficult in an already increasingly difficult climate.
Do you feel that the smaller clinics that may rely more heavily on federal funding will end up being shuttered eventually?
The financial requirements that I mentioned earlier, those physical separation requirements, mm-hmm. are going to absolutely fall on small independent clinics. And, you know, we are talking about places where in rural America, where, you know, where I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, for example, there could be hundreds of miles between places, between Title X clinics. And so when those close, when those doors shutter, we are talking about healthcare deserts in very vulnerable parts of the country. And this is something that we will see tangibly in health outcomes pretty quickly too. So I think closing clinics is a very real concern for the small folks that are out there just trying to provide care.
Right. So it's not that those clinics disappearing will now suddenly mean that those areas don't have access to abortion. Those areas will not have access to healthcare.
Correct. Absolutely. I mean, we know that these clinics are also doing things like routine cancer screenings and providing flu shots when folks come in, mm-hmm. referrals to other healthcare providers for, you know, non-reproductive healthcare related issues that come up. And so it is absolutely closing off access to healthcare in the name of advocating against abortion.
So if the court's decision to allow HHS to begin enforcing the rule means that they feel that the rule will stand up, is the only recourse then a change in administration to try to restore this?
I think it's worth keep fighting in the courts, but I do think that what history has taught us is that this is a fight that ebbs and flows depending on which political party is in charge. And a change of administration, God forbid the Democrats take power and not undo these changes, but a change in administration is absolutely a fundamental aspect of getting these restrictions reversed.
So is this also the kind of thing that a group like Planned Parenthood may, you know, be able to use to continue to raise awareness and funds for the services it and other clinics provide? I mean, there's been this huge push. Eventually there's always a backlash. So as the anti-abortionists win, pro-choice Americans, who are the majority, become more and more outraged. Can a group like Planned Parenthood get something positive out of this very, very destructive, you know, news?
It's going to be a challenge for a couple of reasons. One, there is the reality that the administration's attacks on the Title X program are not the only attacks on reproductive health care that the organizations like Planned Parenthood are responding to. We've got unprecedented amount of increasingly unconstitutional abortion bans in the states. It's also important that this is happening when Planned Parenthood is having its leadership fight right now. And so I think we may see a pivot towards being more aggressive in this stance because, you know, I don't want to say that they will, you know, sort of fundraise and make something positive about it when we are all hands on deck at this point in terms of pushing back against these kinds of restrictions at both the state and the federal level. But this could provide for a galvanizing moment for folks. The concern I have, though, is because it's Title X and it primarily impacts low-income folks, that political will not be as strong as we've seen in some of the other fights. I hope I'm wrong, though.
Let's talk about what is known about this tumultuous change in leadership at Planned Parenthood. I mentioned Dr. Liana Nguyen. She was essentially ousted by the board in what she says was a secret meeting, and that there were philosophical differences. She had only served for 10 months. And her tenure, you know, when her hiring, when it was first announced, was considered important because for the first time, it might have been for the first time ever, but at least for the first time in a long time, there was a woman of color at the head of this important provider and political organization, actually, I should say. So what do you think happened?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. I think the timing is unfortunate in many ways because we have so many fights happening right now, and we are careening into the 2020 presidential election at a time when we need an organization like Planned Parenthood for America, absolutely flexing as much of its political muscle as it can. At the same time, it might be that this was a necessary move in order to allow Planned Parenthood to flex its political muscle as much as it can in this particularly precarious time. If, you know, from what we've seen of the reports concerning Dr. Nguyen's reluctance to prioritize abortion as an essential service that Planned Parenthood provides. So I think part of it is we have to have let the dust settle and see. The new acting executive director has a lot of social justice background and advocacy work, and appears, you know, and has been on the board of Planned Parenthood for some time. So it's not as though the organization is without a head or direction or anything like that. So those are all positive signs, but it's always difficult to have some kind of shakeup like this come when it feels like the attacks are happening from all sides, and we are hopefully not fighting amongst ourselves at the same time.
Right. The timing is certainly quite terrible. And I want to quote from a news piece reiterating what you just said, written by your colleague Dennis Carter on Rewire.news, that apparently in January, Dr. Nguyen reiterated her commitment to protecting abortion rights against a wave of anti-choice state-level restrictions after a report suggested she would move away from emphasizing abortion as a centerpiece of Planned Parenthood's mission. So that may be a hint as to what happened. And the new head of Planned Parenthood, or she's, as you said, the acting head, is a woman named Alexis McGill Johnson. And I guess it's not clear yet whether she will remain in that position permanently or is just a placeholder until they find a new head, right?
Yes, my understanding is that they are undergoing the process for a replacement for Dr. Nguyen, but I am not privy to the hows and whens of how that goes on. But we'll see. You know, I do know that there are a lot of folks at the organization who are absolutely dedicated to fighting as hard and as they can and pushing back on all of these restrictions, and they are doing good work on the inside. I know that there were people who felt like the environment had become difficult and had chosen to leave. So I hope that this is an opportunity for the organization to just, you know, take a breath and really move forward, because we need that right now.
Right. And the previous head, Cecile Richards, who took on a very prominent and activist role at Planned Parenthood, had led that organization for 12 years. So, you know, there was very little turnover, and to have Dr. Nguyen leave within 10 months certainly suggests that there's some sort of internal discussion and debate going on at this really critical juncture. And I'm wondering, Jessica, what your opinion is on the direction of this fight. On the one hand, of course, because anti-abortionists have been so successful at the state and the federal level, it feels as though digging one's heels in and holding firm on the right to abortion is the right way to go. On the other hand, does focusing on abortion this much have a negative consequence to women's health overall?
You know, I believe that abortion is healthcare, and all healthcare fights in this country are political. So we can't separate abortion out in that equation. And so for me, I think my personal opinion is that it is important to have the fight over abortion and to be full-throated in our support of it, because there's no reason to believe, and history certainly doesn't suggest, that if conservatives are successful at attacking and eliminating illegal abortion, for example, that that's where they will that's where they will end. And we don't really have to look any further than the fight over the Affordable Care Act for that. You know, the fight over abortion rights is happening at the same time that Republicans are in the courts trying to repeal, without anything to replace, healthcare reform broadly. And so we need a political opposition at the moment that can connect all of those dots. And to do that, you have to dig in on abortion, I think, because it is inseparable from this all healthcare is political and politicized conversation that we're having.
I'm really glad you brought up the issue of the Affordable Care Act, because yes, that's absolutely the framing of this whole fight. And Republicans just seem to not pay much political price for fighting these fights. If anything, they seem to be energizing their base, or at least deriving some energy from their base. And, you know, it's just really quite remarkable to see the way in which these things are going. And you have the presence of a justice like Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And I'm not sure if you've heard that there are several efforts to replace Susan Collins in Maine, because she was one of the deciding votes on Brett Kavanaugh. And so certainly there is pushback from Americans who are angry with how the fight to protect abortion is going. And I'm wondering, Jessica, finally, where people can find the work that you do. What do you think are the next steps on this particular Title X funding story, you know, and where people can turn to for information?
Well, absolutely go to rewire.news, where we're covering this issue as closely as we can. And in terms of next steps, we will see how the courts approach this. You know, the litigation, as you had mentioned, we talked a little bit about, is ongoing. And then really, we have a big election that we need to focus on. And that is a tremendously important part and component of this fight. We've seen with the midterm election what happens when progressives are put into power. And so we have the opportunity to expand on that. And should we be able to capitalize on that, then that is a much more effective way on the Title X fight of pushing back than relying on the federal courts. Because the last thing I'll just say on that point is, you know, and I've mentioned this when we've talked in the past too, Republicans have been extremely successful in tilting the courts hard to the right under the Trump administration. And what we need to do politically when we are talking about issues of civil rights is understand that we cannot just simply have the federal courts as our firewall. We don't have the ability to trust them the way that we had in the past. And so I think that's going to force some different conversations as we figure out how to address these things.
Right. Electoral politics are important, no matter what we, you know, whether we want them to be or not.
Exactly.
They certainly are. Jessica, thank you as always for joining us.
Oh, thank you as always for having me.
My guest has been Jessica Mason-Piclo, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. And in fact, that website is where you can read her writings. We've been discussing the enforcement of the rule on Title X funding and other related issues around Planned Parenthood. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Presidents throughout American history have enabled corporate excess, even at the expense of public welfare. And yet they promise to uphold the Constitution and the rights of all Americans, making the case that our economic and political systems are inherently geared toward corruption. My next guest has written a history book all about it. Michael Powelson teaches at LA Valley College and Cal State University Channel Islands. His new book is called Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, Alexander Hamilton's name is quite well known these days thanks to the popular musical that Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote. And, you know, it sort of tends to probably gloss over the specific part of the of Hamilton's story that you write about. But let's first start, step back, and I want to ask you what it was that your goal was in writing this book. Is it that every president commits business fraud, and so someone needs to write about it?
Pretty much, but you know, I thought I would give the A team. You know, the reality of American economic history is that from the very beginning of the Republic, it's just inundated with scandals and frauds and swindles of one sort or another. And you know, I tell my students, I'm just the messenger. I'm not making any of this up. And it's, you know, it's a reality historically, and I would say up to the present day, we can expect more of these kinds of things.
So let's talk about the where you start in your book. You have a very, very interesting analysis of parts of our history that we don't often pay much attention to. And Alexander Hamilton is a good place to start. So tell us about the about what it was that he did that you think Americans need to know.
Well, Hamilton was the very first Treasury Secretary of the United States, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think he was a really brilliant guy, great writer, dynamic person, but he was not beyond, you know, the occasional fraud or grift. And as I tell my students, I don't need my heroes to be perfect, and he was very less than perfect. And as Treasury Secretary, he scammed the early government by telling his friends and relatives that he was going to bail out all of the Revolutionary War debt at face value with interest. And so his friends went out and bought up these war debts, which people thought were worthless. And of course, once he proposed his bill, and there was a big argument about that, why are we paying them off with at face value with interest? And the reason was is that Hamilton sought to enrich you know, his friends and relatives, if not himself. He was accused of benefiting from this. He denied it and said that he didn't make any money from it. It was kind of a gray area back then, but it would clearly be insider trading now. It would be a criminal offense what he did back then. But he wasn't the only one, because Jefferson and Madison and the Southern delegation also stood to benefit, because there was a backroom agreement made between them, actually in New York City, at Jefferson's residence, where his slave was waiting on him and the three of them over dinner. They agreed that Hamilton would support what was called the Resident Bill, and that's where they would locate the new capital along the Potomac. And he would also tell his friends in the Northeast delegation to support this bill. In exchange, Jefferson and Washington and Madison and other Southern politicians would support what's called the Assumption Bill to pay off all this seemingly worthless Revolutionary War debt. The great tragedy was that, well, you know, the fraud was that, you know, people like Jefferson and Madison and Washington made a lot of money out of what was essentially swampland. If you've ever been to Washington, D.C., you know that it's built on a swamp, and it was virtually worthless, except if you announce that the new republic's capital will be located there. But the great tragedy is that it was the new capital is going to be located in the heart of the slaveocracy. And as difficult as it would already be to abolish slavery in the new republic, that made it 1,000 times worse, because You know, every bed that was made, every meal that was made, every brick that was laid had the taint of slavery on it. And so it was a very cynical deal that was carried out in the first years of the Republic that was intended to, you know, defraud the Treasury, to defraud the American people, to make a handful of people money. It's that simple.
So not just Hamilton's family and friends, some members of Congress, future presidents?
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's been the case, you know, from the beginning. And of course, you know, Hamilton has his defenders, and Washington and all these guys. There's a tendency in American history, unfortunately, to sort of gloss over these things or to romanticize them. But that's not my role, and that's not the role of social scientists. And like I said, I mean, these guys did some very admirable things as well, but they were also involved in a lot of nefarious things.
In that specific case, which goes to, you know, the historical origins of this nation, was there ever any accountability?
Well, Hamilton was accused of fraud. He denied it. They were all accused in the press of being fraudulent, and they pretty much weathered it, as today, you know, with the collapse of 2007, 2008. There was a lot of fraud that went on, and the people that carried it out, they denied it, and they weathered it, and now they write books that praise themselves about how they, you know, saved the global economy, when in fact they engaged in a lot of nefarious swindles. So this is a long-standing practice in American history, that the people that engineer these things deny them, and you know, they've got powerful friends in the press and the media, the academic world, you know, and they simply they weather it, and then they reinvent the whole thing.
Andrew Jackson is another person that you write about, and he's of course someone that Trump claims to admire. What did Jackson do that was in the similar vein, if you will, to Hamilton?
Well, you know, he's not one of the good guys in American history. He was a slave owner, and he enjoyed his position, and he was not nice to his slaves. On that alone, it's difficult to be too praising of him. He also was a proud Indian killer, and going back to his earliest days, and the War of 1812, you know, cut a swath through the Southeast that more than anything just slaughtered a lot of Indians and dislocated a lot of Indians. He was involved in the Seminole Wars. He had two British subjects summarily executed. He was a duelist. He liked to get in these duels, and he you know, murdered at least one individual. So he was a brawling, hard-fighting kind of ignoramus of a guy.
Which explains a lot about Trump's admiration of him, of course.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels. But, you know, when he was elected president, you know, of course, he signed the Indian Removal Act, which is one of the great tragedies in American history. But also, he was against the Second U.S. National Bank, which is the earlier version of the Federal Reserve. And he just refused to renew the charter, even though Congress had voted to renew it and most people wanted to renew it. He was a populist, a phony populist, and he said that he wanted to free that money up for the interior, for the American pioneers and settlers. But it was a big fraud, because the money that was supposed to be deposited into the Second U.S. National Bank was then deposited into regional state banks. And it turns out that the owners of these banks were friends of Jackson's, and they really misused these deposits. I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but our banking system is based on, it's a fractional banking system. So every federal dollar that was deposited in one of these banks, $10 would be issued, or notes from these individual banks. Well, these guys were issuing $100 notes for every federal dollar, $200 notes. There was money all over the place. And they did it because they felt that now, that with the backing of Jackson, that people would think their banks were solid. Well, of course, they weren't. And so the financial system collapsed. And Jackson made it worse by then declaring that federal lands could only be purchased with gold and silver, which then sent the message that all these notes from all of these, quote, pet banks of Jackson's, and that's what they called them, pet banks, because they were Jackson's little pets. These bank notes that were issued were worthless, and that made things even worse. And then to add it all together, he also decided that he was going to pay off the federal debt, and which he did do. by removing Indians and selling Indian lands. That was a very nefarious thing. But at the end of the day, by paying off all of the outstanding federal debt, that meant that money was not devoted to paying federal employees for construction projects, for canals, for the military's expenditures, for infrastructural things, and the economy just literally collapsed. The Panic of 1837 is arguably the worst that this country's ever experienced. And, you know, there are people that want to get rid of the Federal Reserve System, want to go back to the gold standard, pay off the federal debt. And there's a great example of Jackson and his nefarious dealings. He did all three, and it was a disaster. So I'm not saying we shouldn't go back to the gold standard now or get rid of the Federal Reserve, but you know, beware of what you wish for, that we did this in U.S. history. It was very corrupt, and it led to a massive economic collapse in 1837.
Hmm. Was he too? Was there any accountability for him or not? In your book, you show several political cartoons and pieces of art commenting on many of these frauds. So obviously there was public discussion and debate about it.
Oh, yeah. Many people criticized him for it. But again, you know, it's the powerful do as they will. And, he denied that he had done anything wrong. And most of the adverse impact of his pet banks and what's called the specie circular and the balancing of the federal budget, all of those effects happened at the end of his second administration. And so Martin Van Buren, who was elected in 1836. He bore the brunt of it. He took office in 1837, and the entire economy had already begun to collapse. I think it's kind of like, you know, Reagan's 8-year run of economic prosperity started to wind down in the late 1980s, and George Herbert Walker Bush had to suffer from some of the economic problems of the previous administration. A similar thing with Jackson, that it was Martin Van Buren that was blamed for all of this. But it was really Jackson and his administration that did these things.
You say that the repercussions were really severe. I mean, of course, this was a couple of centuries ago, but we were talking about, and so people may not know that history well, but the Panic of 1837, as it was called, very seriously damaged the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I provide a analysis on the Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. He was hurt mightily as a result of that. And, you know, I see the Raven as a metaphor, very definitely. And, you know, Stephen Foster, the great folk music writer of the 19th century, hard times come again no more. The dislocation, the poverty, many, many riots. There were riots in Baltimore. There were riots in Cincinnati. There was much anger, and the troops were called out. It was also the beginning of the real municipal police forces. Up until then, people might be surprised, like New York did not have a police department. Boston didn't have one. They had a check system for evening night watch, and then private companies basically paid their own guys to keep guard on their banks and factories. But they brought in a modern police force with modern techniques to, you know, terrorized the local population that was suffering mightily from this horrible, horrible depression.
And eventually we even got a war, right? In 1846, the Mexican-American War. And today we talk a lot about the border with Mexico and the crisis on the border. But that border was the site of a pretty serious battle in 1846.
Precisely. The U.S. had signed the Adams-Onis Treaty, which the border between Mexico and the United States was very clear. And it's the border now between Texas and Louisiana, and it runs up between Texas and Oklahoma and then all the way to the northern part of California. And it's hard to get around that treaty. The U.S. agreed to that, and they egregiously violated it. John Tyler annexed it, and then Polk launched an invasion. And, you know, people like Ulysses S. Grant were absolutely livid over this Mexican-American War, because they knew the real thing here was to bring in more territory for slavery. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln as well was very opposed to this. But it did get the U.S. out of this horrible panic, recession, depression of 1837. It took that long. It wasn't until 1845, 1846. And unfortunately, the U.S. economy has constantly turned to military expenditures to get it out of economic wreck and ruin, and up to the present day.
So let's turn to some of the other stories in your book, which I should remind our audience is called Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. You write about the Union Pacific Railroad. You know, and of course, we hear a lot about government contracts and corruption and people rewarding their friends, the revolving door between government and private businesses. How did the story of the transcontinental railway system enter into your history?
Well, the problem, of course, was there wasn't enough government oversight from the beginning. And this is, you know, a thesis that runs throughout the book, is that our government has always been there to enrich the business class. This idea that our government is there as an opposition to business and hurts business and undermines business, this is absolutely wrong. It just doesn't fit with the historic record. As James Madison, you know, famously put it, the whole purpose of the U.S. government was, quote, to protect the minority of the opulent, end quote. And that is exactly what has gone on. The Transcontinental Congress created the Union Pacific Railroad, they created the Central Pacific Railroad, and then they funneled huge sums of money to these companies, which then created dummy companies. For the Union Pacific, it was called Credit Mobilier. And Union Pacific was paying Credit Mobilier huge sums of money to actually construct the Transcontinental. A pickaxe that should have cost $10 was charged $100.
Wow.
A rail tie that was $5 was $50. And people thought these were separate companies, but in fact, they were basically a dummy company, similar to what Ken Lay did with Enron. And the result was that Union Pacific went bankrupt, and people would think that, well, how does that benefit the shareholders? Well, the shareholders of Union Pacific knew they were bankrupting the company, and they sold their shares before anybody else found out about it, so they got top dollar value. And then they still held stock in Credit Mobilier, which was very, very profitable, and they went to Congress and they said, sorry, we went broke, you're going to have to give us more money. And Congress did. They didn't want to, they had promised the nation, the world, that they would build this transcontinental. It was a big fraud, and it went on for years, up until the late 19th century, with them trying to game the system. At the end of the day, it cost well more than it should have to build that railroad. It was a giant swindle. And in fact, they had to rebuild most all of it, because it was so poorly constructed. If you pay reward people to build railroad tracks by the mile, they're going to build without any, quality control. They built railroad tracks that were unsafe, didn't work, but that wasn't in the contract. So much of the frauds and swindles that are carried out are to the letter of the law. J.P. Morgan made his first fortune selling defective rifles during the American Civil War. These are rifles that blew thumbs off of the soldiers that fired them. And the U.S. Army refused to pay him. He took them to court and he said, look, the contract said I have to deliver rifles. It didn't say they had to work. Mm. And the court said, I guess he's right about that. And he got his money. So much of what happens that is a fraud or a swindle in American economic history is ruled technically legal. But I don't really care about that. I mean, a fraud is still a fraud. It's still a fraud. I don't care if they can find some legal nicety around it. Or in the case of J.P. Morgan selling dangerous rifles to Union, to the Union Army, which hurt and injured so many soldiers.
So let's fast forward to more recent years. Your book has a lengthy history, and certainly our audience can pick up a copy and explore the ensuing centuries and decades. In the more recent presidential 10 years of George W. Bush, even Barack Obama, and certainly Trump, how has this tradition of government fraud to enrich private businesses continued?
Well, I know that it can bother people who are, you know, Democrats or Obama supporters, but I really didn't see any difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Under Bush, Henry Paulson was the CEO, was the Treasury Secretary. He's a Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs CEO. And he was the one that engineered the transfer of trillions of dollars to Wall Street to bail them out, in complete violation of our the most basic understanding of capitalism, which just shows how uninterested, you know, the corporate business class is in really following their own rules. I mean, if they can get the government to give them trillions of dollars, why wouldn't they do it? If you can argue with them that that's not legitimate, that's not capitalism, they don't care any more than they cared about the Transcontinental Railroad as being, you know, following any kind of a capitalist model. And then Obama gets elected, and he continues. He nominates Timothy Geithner, who was himself a corporate lawyer. He worked for the Kissinger, very secretive Kissinger firm, and he continued with the transference of trillions of dollars of wealth to Wall Street. At the
was
end of the day,
was this more of the revolving door issue, or was there, as far as you can tell, real fraud of the kinds that you were talking historically that was committed?
Well, I would call this fraud because, you know, they put people in positions of power that gave Wall Street trillions of dollars. And, you know, the problem with swindlers is that they never admit that they swindled anything. People have heard about Charles Ponzi. He never, ever admitted that he did anything wrong. He said he was in over his head. That's the same thing with Ken Lay. Is that he denied, the former Enron executive, that he did anything wrong. It's left to our we historians to make that judgment call. And by any measure, the $17 trillion went missing and nobody got charged. Nobody was convicted. Nobody went to prison over this. And at the end of the day, millions of people lost their homes, they lost their jobs, they lost their retirement. And we're living in a, you know, a world where people are, most of us are living on the margins of paycheck to paycheck, and the people on Wall Street are rolling in dough. And it's not because of their genius as capitalists. They got $17 trillion handed over to them, the latest count. If you divide that to every man, woman, and child in the United States, that's like $36,000 each, or $144,000 for a family of four.
So,
right.
Michael, as a historian, then, how do you view the Trump presidency, who seems to have upped the ante even on his predecessors? He promised to drain the swamp, but all he seems to have done is fill it even higher.
Well, again, I mean, look at the people that he appointed, Steve Mnuchin. I mean, he's a corporate raider of the first sort. Nothing's going to change with that. I was making that point with Barack Obama. As much as people, you know, wanted him to have hope and change, I mean, basically by handing over the economy to the Wall Street corporate interests, which is what he did, which is what GW did, which is what Bill Clinton did. Nothing's going to change. And these guys are hardwired. They can't think of it in any other way. For them, if they are enriched and profits are booming, that means it's good for everybody. It's that old rag about, you know, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. And they absolutely believe it. They refuse to think that they've ever engaged in any kind of a fraud or swindle. And of course, you know, that goes back to Alexander Hamilton. I mean, I've said many times to my students that the first swindler that a swindler swindles is themselves. You know, they lie to themselves, and it's left to us, the American taxpayer and academics and politicians of all stripes, to decide, you know, what is going on with the global economy, the U.S. economy. It is, you know, I mean, with the, they just signed off the largest defense bill ever in U.S. history. And where exactly are the threats? You know, I mean,
$733 billion bill, and that's just the House version. The Senate went even higher, 750 something.
As they cut, you know, social welfare programs. And this goes back to the Reagan administration David Stockman, who believed that even though social welfare programs were quite popular, and they were, housing, education, healthcare programs, and also they were quite successful. They weren't busting the U.S., you know, economy or treasury. they didn't believe in it. They don't believe in that stuff. They don't believe the government should in any way subsidize housing, healthcare, education. They think all the money should just go to Wall Street. They've always thought that.
And so then finally
the way
is
around
that...
it is to just starve the beast, you know, to keep cutting money. Right. I'm teaching at LA Valley College, and you know, this is located in the wealthiest state and the wealthiest country in the world, and they keep cutting funding for community colleges. They cut funding for the public school system. They cut funding. I also teach at the CSU, a public institution. They keep claiming they don't have any money. It's not true, of course. There's plenty of money. But you know, this is the new thinking going back to the Reagan administration. And unfortunately, Democrats sign on to that. You know that California has this giant surplus of money, right?
Right.
And they claim that it's for a rainy day or whatever, that come up with some kind of an argument for it. But
even though this is the nation's most liberal state. Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate the work you've done, and thank you for shedding light on this history and the current.
All right, bye-bye.
My guest has been Michael Powelson. He teaches at LA Valley College and Cal State University, Channel Islands. We've been discussing his new book, Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
It's 8:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Next up, stay tuned for Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the rally against war in Iran and Venezuela on Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park in Portland. This march and rally will primarily focus on the possibility of U.S. military intervention in Iran and Venezuela, but also calling attention to the use of sanctions as economic war. Again, that's the rally against war in Iran and Venezuela, and sanctions kill people too. On Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park, downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Willem van Spronsen. That's the name. And it's a name you're supposed to forget. I want to read from La Resistencia's statement on the shooting death at the